Postscript. With the record of my sentence of transportation, my life as a rogue ends, and my existence as a respectable man begins. I am sorry to say anything which may disturb popular delusions on the subject of poetical justice, but this is strictly the truth. My first anxiety was about my wife's future. Mr. Butterbury gave me no chance of asking his advice after the trial. The moment sentence had been pronounced, he allowed himself to be helped out of court in a melancholy state of prostration, and the next morning he left for London. I suspect he was afraid to face me, and nervously impatient, besides, to tell Annabella that he had saved the legacy again by another alarming sacrifice. My father and mother, to whom I had written on the subject of Alicia, were no more to be depended on than Mr. Batterbury. My father, in answering my letter, told me that he conscientiously believed he had done enough in forgiving me for throwing away an excellent education and disgracing a respectable name. He added that he had not allowed my letter for my mother to reach her, out of pitying regard for her broken health and spirits, and he ended by telling me, what was perhaps very true, that the wife of such a son as I had been had no claim upon her father-in-law's protection and help. There was an end, then, of any hope of finding resources for Alicia among the members of my own family. The next thing was to discover a means of providing for her without assistance. I had formed a project for this, after meditating over my conversations with the returned transport in Barkingham Jail, and I had taken a reliable opinion on the chances of successfully executing my design from the solicitor who had prepared my defence. Alicia herself was so earnestly in favour of assisting in my experiment that she declared she would prefer death to its abandonment. Accordingly, the necessary preliminaries were arranged, and when we parted, it was some mitigation of our grief to know that there was a time appointed for meeting again. Alicia was to lodge with a distant relative of her mother's in a suburb of London, was to concert measures with this relative on the best method of turning her jewels into money, and was to follow her convict husband to the Antipodes, under a feigned name, in 6 months' time. If my family had not abandoned me, I need not have thus left her to help herself. As it was, I had no choice. One consolation supported me at parting. She was in no danger of persecution from her father. A second letter from him had arrived at Crickgelly, and had been forwarded to the address I had left for it. It was dated Hamburg, and briefly told her to remain at Crickgelly and expect fresh instructions, explanations, and a supply of money, as soon as he had settled important business matters which had taken him abroad. His daughter answered the letter, telling him of her marriage, and giving him an address at the post office to write to, if he chose to reply to her communication. There the matter rested. What was I to do on my side? Nothing but establish a reputation for mild behaviour. I began to manufacture a character for myself for the first days of our voyage out in the convict ship, and I landed at the penal settlement with the reputation of being the meekest and most biddable of felonious mankind. After a short probationary experience of such low convict employments as lime-burning and road-mending, I was advanced to occupations more in harmony with my education. Whatever I did, I never neglected the first great obligation of making myself agreeable and amusing to everybody. My social reputation as a good fellow began to stand as high at one end of the world as ever it stood at the other. The months passed more quickly than I had dared to hope. The expiration of my first year of transportation was approaching, and already pleasant hints of my being soon assigned to private service began to reach my ears. This was the first of the many ends I was now working for, and the next pleasant realization of my hopes that I had to expect was the arrival of Alicia. She came a month later than I had anticipated. Safe and blooming, with £500 as the produce of her jewels, and with the old Crickgelly alias, changed from Miss to Mrs. Giles, to prevent any suspicions of the connection between us. Her story, concocted by me before I left England, was that she was a widow lady who had come to settle in Australia and make the most of her little property in the New World. One of the first things Mrs. Giles wanted was necessarily a trustworthy servant, and she had to make her choice of one among the convicts of good character to be assigned to private service. Being one of that honourable body myself at the time, it is needless to say that I was the fortunate man on whom Mrs. Giles' choice fell. The first situation I got in Australia was as servant to my own wife. Alicia made a very indulgent mistress. If she had been mischievously inclined, she might, by application to a magistrate, have had me flogged or set to work in chains on the roads whenever I became idle or insubordinate, which happened occasionally. But instead of complaining, the kind creature kissed and made much of her footman by stealth after his day's work. She allowed him no female followers, and only employed one woman servant occasionally, who was both old and ugly. The name of the footman was Dear in private, and Francis in company. And when the widowed mistress upstairs refused eligible offers of marriage, which was pretty often, the favoured domestic in the kitchen was always informed of it, and asked, with the sweetest humility, if he approved of the proceeding. Not to dwell on this anomalous period of my existence, let me say briefly that my new position with my wife was of the greatest advantage in enabling me to direct in secret the profitable uses to which her little fortune was put. We began in this way with an excellent speculation in cattle, buying them for shillings and selling them for pounds. With the profits thus obtained, we next tried our hands at houses, first buying in a small way, then boldly building, and letting again and selling to great advantage. While these speculations were in progress, my behaviour in my wife's service was so exemplary, and she gave me so excellent a character when the usual official inquiries were instituted, that I soon got the next privilege accorded to persons in my situation, a ticket of leave. By the time this had been again exchanged for a conditional pardon, which allowed me to go about where I pleased in Australia, and to trade in my own name like any unconvicted merchant, our house property had increased enormously. Our land had been sold for public buildings, and we had shares in the famous Emancipist Bank, which produced quite a little income of themselves. There was now no need to keep the mask on any longer. I went through the superfluous ceremony of a second marriage with Alicia, took stores in the city, built a villa in the country, and here I am at this present moment of writing, a convict aristocrat, a prosperous, wealthy, highly respectable mercantile man, with 2 years of my sentence of transportation still to expire. I have a barouche and 2 bay horses, a coachman and page in neat liveries, 3 charming children, and a French governess, a boudoir and lady's maid for my wife. She is as handsome as ever, but getting a little fat. So am I, as a worthy friend remarked when I recently appeared holding the plate at our last charity sermon. What would my surviving relatives and associates in England say if they could see me now? I have heard of them at different times and through various channels. Lady Malkinshaw, after living to the verge of 100 and surviving all sorts of accidents, died quietly one afternoon in her chair with an empty dish before her and without giving the slightest notice to anybody. Mr. Batterbury, having sacrificed so much to his wife's reversion, profited nothing by its falling in at last. His quarrels with my amiable sister, which took their rise from his interested charities toward me, ended in producing a separation. And far from saving anything by Annabella's inheritance of her pin money, he had a positive loss to put up with, in the shape of some hundreds extracted yearly from his income as alimony to his uncongenial wife. He is said to make use of shocking language whenever my name is mentioned, and to wish that he had been carried off by the yellow fever before he ever set eyes on the Softly family. My father has retired from practice. He and my mother have gone to live in the country, near the mansion of the only Marquis with whom my father was actually and personally acquainted in his professional days. The Marquis asks him to dinner once a year, and leaves a card for my mother before he returns to town for the season. A portrait of Lady Malkinshaw hangs in the dining room. In this way, my parents are ending their days contentedly. I can honestly say that I am glad to hear it. Dr. Dulcifer, when I last heard of him, was editing a newspaper in America. Old File, who shared his flight, still shares his fortunes, being publisher of his newspaper. Young File resumed coining operations in London, and, having braved his fate a second time, threaded his way, in due course, up to the steps of the scaffold. Screw carries on the profitable trade of informer in London. The dismal disappearance of Mill I have already recorded. So much on the subject of my relatives and associates. On the subject of myself, I might still write on at considerable length, but while the libelous title of A Rogue's Life stares me in the face at the top of the page, how can I, as a rich and reputable man, be expected to communicate any further autobiographical particulars in this place to a discerning public of readers? No, no, my friends, I am no longer interesting. I am only respectable like yourselves. It is time to say goodbye.